So what I thought would be a reasonable way to do this morning is to take the most extreme psychedelic case and experience and describe it and talk about it a little and then see what issues that raises. Because my experience with this stuff has led me to the conclusion that in a way it's to be thought of, this other dimension is to be thought of like a mandala, and different psychedelic compounds and generously different kinds of yoga and different kinds of techniques of all sorts land you in different parts of this mandala, but that what you're always trying to do is get to the center of the mandala. And it's simply my bias, my opinion, but I think the center of the mandala is probably the DMT experience for a number of reasons. And so I thought it would be interesting to talk about it this morning. First, let me talk about it physically. DMT is an indole hallucinogen, a tryptamine, and it's produced endogenously in the human brain. This is very interesting. Very few psychedelic compounds are produced in the human brain. We don't know what DMT is doing there, but it means essentially that we all are subject to arrest on a technicality because we all are holding a Schedule 1 drug. It's sort of the ultimate catch-22, where if all else fails, they just say, well, you were holding anyway. The interesting thing about DMT, another interesting thing about it is that it's incredibly rapid in its onset and in its disappearance. The whole trip lasts about 15 minutes. This makes it a tremendous tool with which to challenge the critics of our position. Because if somebody wants to rise up in righteous wrath and condemn psychedelics, then you say, well, you have tried them, haven't you? And of course they never have. It's like scientific denunciations of astrology. I mean, scientists love to denounce astrology, but find one who can cast a natal horoscope and I'll give you a hen's tooth. You know, so DMT overcomes this objection. The entire experience lasts 15 minutes. So you say to the critic, you know, you're not going to experience this, and yet you're going to carry on a pogrom against it. You won't invest 15 minutes to checking out what this is about. You know, what kind of scientist are you? So it has that social efficacy. Now, the fact that it is the strongest of all hallucinogens, at least if there are ones stronger, please keep them away from me. I mean, I don't think anybody needs to get higher than that. I certainly don't. I mean, I've at times come out of those places and said, this stuff is illegal. You know, it breaks cosmic law. Of course, then Tim Leary told me that cosmic laws are only local ordinances anyway, so it didn't really matter. Okay. Well, good question. Yes, it's the commonest of all hallucinogens in nature. It occurs in many grasses, Phalaris tuberosa, Phalaris arundinaceae. It occurs in a number of leguminous plants, probably the most spectacular being Anadenanthera peregrina, this huge tropical locust-like tree from which the snuff called neopa or ipina is made. That's a tough way to get your DMT, let me tell you, because there's so much cellulose and other crap and corruption in the mix that you have to do like a tablespoon up each nostril. And the technique is you get a bamboo tube or a hollow tube about this long and you pour in this tablespoon of this stuff, and then you squat down on your haunches and you get a friend and you put the tube up your nostril, and then the friend blows with the full force of his breath, blows the stuff into your head. Well, you fall. It's like being hit in the face with a 2x4. I mean, it's like you think he kicked you, and you fall over backwards. You scream. You salivate. You get back up on your haunches, and by this time he has refilled the tube for the other nostril. So, and then after, Yopo, Ipina, Nipa, it depends on the language group, and the Waika, the Yanomami, it's also called Vilka in the Carib language. And then after 10 minutes or so, it slowly begins to form up in your head. But, you know, God, your sinuses are in staff for sure. And it's not very pleasant. And the other thing is, it never reaches the blinding transformative intensity that you can achieve with the chemically pure compound. No. That good point. If you orally ingest it, it will be destroyed in your guts. It won't work. The Amazon Indians have encountered this problem and created a very sophisticated pharmacological strategy for dealing with this. You've all heard of ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is DMT from one plant combined with another plant which contains a chemical which is called an MAO inhibitor. MAO is monoamine oxidase, and your gut is full of MAO, and its job is to take monoamines, small molecules, and oxidize them into a harmless byproduct, usually indole acetic acid, which can be shunted to the bladder. Well, when you take DMT orally, these monoamines these monoamine oxidase compounds just grab onto it and destroy it. But if you take an MAO inhibitor with it, and harmine, which occurs in Banisteriopsis caapi, is an MAO inhibitor, then, lo and behold, it isn't destroyed in your gut. Instead, it passes into the bloodstream. It passes through the blood-brain barrier, which is a very tight chemical filter that keeps the brain from being exposed to toxic materials. But these drugs can cross that barrier. And then what the ayahuasca experience really is a slow-release DMT trip that instead of taking 5 minutes, takes about 2.5 hours. And if you really know your psychedelics and your breath control techniques on ayahuasca, over an hour or so, you can work yourself to a place where you say, Lordy me, it looks just like a DMT flash. And it does, but you've had to do some hard climbing to get there. With DMT itself, once you push the start button, there's no stopping it. And I think it's worth describing it. How many people have had this experience? Well, so they can somewhat anchor it. It's very subjective, obviously, but I will describe what happens to me, and then we can work out from there. One point that I want to make about these things is that the great strength of the psychedelic possibility is it's democratic. You know, it isn't that people of great spiritual advancement attain these states, or people who have studied under some lineage. It's truly available to everyone. And when I had my DMT experiences, I realized, you know, either I am incredibly special, which there's no other evidence to support that, or this is something which can happen to anyone. And that's the more interesting possibility. After all, if it can only happen to very, very special people, then that lets most people out. But if it's generally available, then it's big, big news about the human condition. Yeah.
How the Indians profoundly complicated ways to do this stuff, since we remains a mystery. But how did they find it in the human brain?
How did they find DMT in the human brain? Interesting question. No, I think he means how did they find that it was endogenously produced. Well, I think they were studying, the group that did this was at the University of Louisiana, Christian and his group, and they were studying fast reactions in the brain. And for fast reactions, you have to look at chemicals that can go through some kind of cycle of structural change and return to their zero point very, very quickly. Their original thought was that DMT mediated attention. I mean, I'm talking to you right now. Suppose there were a loud noise over here. We would all immediately project our mind onto the source of the sound. They thought that that was a neurological function mediated by DMT. Could be, I'm not sure. I suspect it has more to do with the chemistry of dreaming. Once they discovered DMT and began to track it, they discovered that there was a circadian rhythm, means a daily rhythm, in its production in the human organism, and that it reaches its greatest concentration in the brain around 3:30 a.m. in most people. Well, this is when the deep dreaming and the high REM states are really chugging. And I suspect, I mean, lucid dreamers may want to argue with this, but I suspect that every night we go deeper places than we can ever speak of, that ordinary dreams are right on the surface of consciousness. Big lucid dreams are an inch deeper, but I think we go 100 feet down every night into places where you cannot say anything about it yet.
I wanted to ask you about availability of DMT for people with like Yahe, and heard you talk about the industry for me.
Let's make that perspiration. Well, it's hard as hell to find DMT. And this is a puzzle, because if you look it up in a standard work on organic chemistry, it presents it as a trivial synthesis, much more simple than LSD, which it always presents as quite a difficult synthesis. But when you actually talk to workbench chemists, it's tricky to make DMT. It's especially tricky to carry out the final crystallization. So what you're usually offered in the underground is some kind of muck, which looks sort of like maple syrup passed on to sugar. I wouldn't get near that, actually. It means they botched their synthesis. What you're hoping for is a white powder. However, in 30 years of chasing this all over the world, I've only seen it as a white powder a couple of times. Usually the synthesis has fallen slightly below that standard, and what you get is a pale yellow powder, sometimes a pale rose or pink powder, and then the real rough trade is orange. And this is what you, if you've seen it, this is probably what you've seen. It looks like orange mothballs. And it has the smell of indole, this very sharp smell, which if you're not a chemist and you've never smelled indole, when you reach in your mind for what is this like, you'll say, well, it's sort of like mothballs. Not quite, but it has that same sharp chemical, you know, and this is what you're going to smoke, see. So a lot of people beef about that and say, well, you know, it's like smoking burning plastic. Yeah, más o menos, but it is a little bit like that. The other objection to DMT that has been around since the 60s is people say it destroys brain cells. There's no evidence for or against this, but I would submit to you, and the people who are neurophysiologists can argue with this if they disagree, but I think an excellent index for the low toxicity of a drug is how fast it clears your system. And DMT clears your system in about 15 minutes. If you take some compound, drug, or whatever, and 48 hours later, you're still taking hot baths and, you know, wishing you could have a massage and sitting staring at the wall, then this drug is really sticking to your ribs. It means that your metabolic pathways have no way of dealing with it. They can't grab it here, they can't grab it there, and it takes a long time to leave your system. An example of this in the pseudo-psychedelic domain would be ketamine. You know, ketamine, the experience lasts about 45 minutes, but 48 hours later you can feel your knees suddenly go rubbery, or you can have what are technically called fugue states, strange states of disconnectedness from what's going on around you. This is not a very good advertisement for a drug. Here, this woman and then you.
I'm curious with the ayahuasca, how much you can take that and the
Well, less, because if you smoke DMT, the dose is approximately 50 milligrams, which is like the size of a kitchen match head. If you combine it with an MAO inhibitor and take it orally, you can probably get away with about 35 milligrams of DMT and 100 milligrams of harmaline. Now, harmaline itself is sometimes described as a psychedelic drug. I really think this is sort of misleading. You will have hallucinations if you take pure harmaline, but only at doses approaching the toxic dose. Many compounds will give you hallucinations approaching the toxic dose. Bee venom, rattlesnake venom, stuff like this. That doesn't mean it's a hallucinogenic drug. It means you're dying, and you should take steps to correct the situation. Now, yes?
You said that there is a short transit time, but how long does the memory of that experience last? Because that would indicate to me that there is still a presence, and perhaps a homeopathic dose at that point, in the mind, in the brain.